Chapter 1.
The apartment looked like a fallout shelter. It was in a sub-sub-basement, 20 feet below street level down a wobbly flight of metal stairs so steep they were practically a ladder. The light at the bottom was burned out, of course, so the landing was pitch black. Also mysteriously wet. No idea how, since we hadn't had any rain in Detroit for a month. But these are the sort of lovely things you discover when you win a cheap bid.
Gonna be one of those jobs, I see, I said, pulling my rubber gloves out of my bag.
At least it's not big,
Sybil chirped in my ear, her computerized voice cheerful as always.
The building's custodian AI says the apartment's a one-bedroom. I bet we can fit the whole thing in one truck.
That's good, I said.
Because one truck is all I have.
I dug out my poncho next, grimacing as I pulled the slick, protective material over my sweat-dampened ponytail. Even down in the underground where the sun never shone, the temperature was already in the upper 80s, and it wasn't even 9 a.m. Not good weather for covering yourself in plastic. But unlike my jeans and long-sleeved work shirt, my poncho was warded. And I'd learned the hard way that drowning in sweat was preferable to walking into someone's no-trespassing curse without protection. All right, I said, cinching the hood of my poncho tight under my chin so that I was draped head-to-toe in spell-worked plastic.
Light her up.
The words were barely out of my mouth when the LEDs on the side of my AR goggles lit up like miniature suns, filling the dank stairwell with blazing white light. It was so bright that I missed the little red recording icon that came on next in the corner of my augmented reality vision. Thankfully, AIs never forgot protocol.
This is the video log for Unit 4B, Building 92, Detroit Free Zone Underground Block 14, Sybil recited. Purchase date, Monday, July 22, 2115. Receipt number 144525. Cleaner ID, Opal Yonge. Do you verify?
This is Opal Yonge, and I verify,
I replied dutifully, hitting the button to flip to my interior camera for a shot of my sweat-streaked face beneath my protective gear.
Proceeding with occupant notification.
CYA out of the way. I slung my work bag around to my back and reached out to knock on the door, trying not to think too hard about the way the furry black spots on the paint squished under my gloves.
Cleaner,
I announced loudly, thanking my lucky stars that I'd had the presence of mind to put on my rebreather before I'd climbed down into all this mold.
If you're inside, open up.
There was no reply.
There was never a reply.
But I always asked, because the one time I didn't, I just knew I'd open the door and find some junkie staring me down with a shotgun. Speaking of, I grabbed a fistful of local magic from the air and slapped it against my poncho to activate the anti-bullet wards. Just in case.
Unit has no reply, I told my recorder. Proceeding with reclamation.
Ready when you are,
Sybil said, flagging the point in the video so that if someone tried to contest this job in arbitration later, I could point to the exact moment at which I stated my intent.
This is Opal Yonge,
I told the almost certainly empty apartment.
Subcontractor for Detroit Free Zone Habitation Management. You're 30 days behind on your rent and have not responded to multiple contact attempts from collections. Therefore, by the terms of your rental agreement with the city, this apartment and all possessions therein are now property of the DFZ.
By which I meant property of me. When people skip town without paying their rent, the city takes their stuff to pay the bill. No bureaucrat wants to deal with sorting through someone else's abandoned junk, though. So they send the unit to auction, where it's bought by someone like me. I'm a cleaner. I buy delinquent apartments in the hopes of selling what's inside for a profit. Sometimes I scored big. Other times, almost every time recently, I paid for the privilege of shoveling trash. Thankfully, on this particular unit, the bar for profit was practically on the ground. I'd gotten the whole thing for $300, basically free. and despite the mold, I already had a good feeling about it. Just as in the picture that had convinced me to bid on the place, I could see the telltale marks of a Ward beneath the dirt on the scuffed edges of the front door's frame. Wards were expensive, and expensive security meant good stuff.
All right,
I said when the silence on the other side of the door had stretched longer than the required 30 seconds.
Let's crack it open and see what we've got.
The red light vanished from my heads-up display as Sybil stopped recording. I gave it a few seconds to be sure, and then I dug my gloved hand into the neck of my poncho to pull out the key I wore around my neck like a crucifix. The master key was a sacred object, and a cleaner's only real identification. It had been made for me by the spirit of the city, and it could open any door in the DFZ if the city believed you had a right to be there. That last bit was the tricky part. Unlike every other city in the world, the Detroit Free Zone was alive. Literally alive. With her own soul, mind, opinions, and occasionally off-the-books real estate deals. Collections tried their best to keep up, but they were only human. Sometimes rent was paid in ways that simply couldn't be reported. When that happened, it didn't matter how long a unit had been in collections. It would never open up. In the 1.5 years that I'd been cleaning, I'd gotten a locked unit only once. But you didn't forget getting stiffed for 2 grand by the living goddess of your city. Thankfully, this was not going to be one of those days. The moment I touched my master key to the lock, the bright silver teeth rearranged themselves like water and slid right in, popping the deadbolt with a satisfying click. The rest of the locks were another matter.
Wow, this guy was paranoid,
Sybil said, bringing up density scanner results at the corner of my right eye.
I'm seeing 4 more deadbolts, 2 chains inside, and a rod in the floor.
Don't forget the ward,
I added, poking at the spellwork I could just barely see painted across the rusted metal door jamb with the steel toe of my boot.
Not that I blame him. Look at where he lived.
The cheap apartment block this unit was at the bottom of was located in one of the lowest points of the DFZ underground, almost 100 feet below the elevated bridges of the skyways that divided the top half of the city, the part with sunlight, super scrapers, trendy restaurants, and luxury housing, from the underground. A cave-like world of underpasses, neon, and cheap rent. Parts of the underground were nicer than others. I, for example, lived in a perfectly respectable walk-up over in Hamtramck, or what had been Hamtramck before Detroit had been destroyed, rebuilt, destroyed again, and then rebuilt again. This wasn't one of the nice bits, though. It wasn't the worst, but it was as bad as I went voluntarily. I didn't have crime stats for the place, so maybe I was prejudging it. But in my experience, anywhere that had more vending machines for guns than for soda wasn't winning any safe neighborhood awards.
These should crack easy enough, though,
I said, shining my lights into the gap between the door and the frame to get a better look at the locks.
The ward's the real problem. If we don't get rid of that, we'll be fried chicken.
You'll be fried chicken, Sybil said smugly. I'm backed up to the cloud.
I rolled my eyes and crouched down, pressing my plastic-covered head against the door so the cameras in my goggles could get a good shot of the spellwork at my feet.
Any clue what it does?
Nope, she said after the picture scanned. 0 matches returned from all spellwork libraries. Looks like a custom job.
I grinned inside my mask. Custom spellwork was the hallmark of a serious mage. Probably an unsavory one since he was hiding down here, but unsavory magic sold even better than legitimate stuff, and cleaners couldn't afford to be picky.
I bet he's got something good in there. Mages are always loaded.
Not always, Sybil said. I mean, you're a mage, and you're broke.
Leave me my hope, I begged as I rose to my feet. It's been a really bad couple of months, so let's just assume this apartment is piled high with priceless magical objects of high resale value.
Whatever you need to tell yourself, Sybil said, But what do you want to do about the ward? This door is the only way in, according to the blueprints.
I frowned at the symbols by my feet. Deciphering spellwork had never been my strong suit, but this stuff looked like arcane chicken scratch. I couldn't even spot the variables that would tell me if this was just an alarm ward or something that would cut your head off if you crossed it. It felt strong, though. Now that I was standing right next to it, I could feel the ward's magic humming even through the soupy ambient power of the DFZ. Whatever this thing did it hard. Which meant my best move was to avoid it entirely. Right, I said, stepping back. Let's try the crowbar. The crowbar was a spell of my own invention. Unlike the deadbeat owner of the apartment I was attempting to loot, I wasn't a thaumaturge who treated magic like a mathematical equation to be solved. I knew enough spellwork to get by. Since it followed logical rules that could be written down, thaumaturgy was the easiest form of magic to teach, which meant it was the one that every mage learned in school. But I could never wrap my head around the higher logic needed to be actually good. For me, magic had always been a feeling, a physical sensation I could trace with my fingers, like dipping my hand into a stream of water. If thaumaturges used spellwork to build complex, logic-gated irrigation systems, then I cast by splashing. As my tutors had lectured me countless times, it was a fast, reckless way to use magic. Or, if they were being less polite, lazy and dangerous. To me, though, it had always been the only way that felt right. I still appreciated quality thaumaturgy. My poncho was proof of that. The thing was covered in top-tier corporate spellwork. But when it came to casting for myself, all those rules and variables just got in the way. It was a lot simpler to do everything freehand, which was what I did right now, reaching out to grab two big fistfuls of the DFZ's ambient magic. As always, touching the city's magic in the underground felt like dipping my fingers into oil-slicked water. Noisy water. The magic down here was full of car horns and voices and the rumble of engines mixed with the smell of greasy street food and wet pavement. Even the texture was different than the magic up on the skyways. Syrupy and thick, like trying to hold motor oil between your fingers. Such thick, slippery power would have been a nightmare to push through spellwork. But when it came to my slapdash casting, the viscosity actually made things easier. I didn't even bother with a casting circle. I just kept pouring the power back and forth between my cupped hands, adding to it in fistfuls until the magic in my hands felt greater than the magic radiating from the ward on the door. This turned out to be slightly more than I could safely hold, so I picked up the pace, squeezing the oozing magic between my hands until it was more or less the shape I wanted, a dense bar with a hook at one end, exactly like a real crowbar. The form was entirely for me. Magic didn't follow actual physics any more than dreams did. But casting was all about understanding. The whole point of spellwork equations was to prove to yourself logically why something would work. Since I'd never fully understood any spellwork, that method had never worked for me. But I knew what a crowbar did. I knew how to jam one into a door and wedge it open, so that was what I did now. Jamming my magic between the ward and the doorframe until the whole thing snapped with an explosive crack. "Whoa!" Sybil said as I jumped away from the splintering wood.
"That's one way to do it."
"At least we don't have to worry about the other locks now," I said, nodding at the door, which had snapped in half from the pressure.
"I know, right?"
my AI agreed.
"Who needs proper casting? Brute force wins again."
"Hey, I do better when I stick to what I'm good at," I said defensively. Then my face split into a grin as I turned the laser-like beams of my headlamps toward the room I'd just revealed. "Let's see what we've got." Being a cleaner is all about being an optimist. No matter how many apartments full of dirty clothes and rat droppings you cleaned out, there was always that chance that the next one would be a treasure trove. And like I said, I had a good feeling about this place.
I dove at what was left of the door like a kid jumping into a pool on the first day of summer, knocking the broken wood out of my way as if it were brittle glass. The more I cleared out, the more excited I became, because the ward on the doorframe was even better than I'd expected. I couldn't see the individual markings anymore now that I'd broken them, but I knew from the burn mark they'd left in the wood that the thing had been seriously powerful. I'd popped it fairly easily, but I broke into apartments, legally, for a living. A more standard mage, one who cared about fancy stuff like preserving spell work or being quiet, would have tried to unlock it and probably gotten themselves fried as a result. Fried and recorded. Now that the door was gone, I could see all kinds of wires running along the ceiling behind it. The entire front foyer of the apartment was rigged with cameras, sensors, and a tripwire leading to a bucket of cement that had been rigged to drop from the top of the coat closet door. If I'd come in normally, that thing would have crushed my head. Which only made me more excited. Whoever had lived down here had clearly been hiding something good. The only question was, had he taken it with him when he'd skipped town without paying his rent? Going by what I could see from the doorway, my guess was no. It didn't look like anyone had ever taken anything out of here. Once he got past the traps at the front, the entire apartment was stacked floor to ceiling with boxes. There were a few canyon-like paths that ran between the stacks, but otherwise the whole place appeared to be little more than a glorified storage locker. My heart began to flutter at the sight. Other than actually scoring a major find, this was my favorite part of being a cleaner. Pulling out my wire cutters, I disarmed the entryway, cutting the trip wires and the power feeds to the sensors. When I was certain I wouldn't get crushed, shot, or garroted by anything automated, I crept inside, stepping into the canyon of boxes like an explorer entering a pharaoh's tomb. That was exactly how I felt, too. Like I was Indiana Jones, the good one from the original classic movies, not the ghastly 17-film reboot they did in the 2040s. I was about to dig into the first pile to see what I'd scored when the smell hit me. "Ugh," I said, stumbling back. "What is that?" It smelled like rotting meat left out on a hot day. Given that the temperature inside the apartment was over 90, the AC was the first thing collections cut off when an account went delinquent, my guess was that something had crawled in and died. But this didn't smell like sewer rat or monovole or any of the other usual suspects. It was also strong enough to get through my rebreather, which meant it was rank. A person without protective gear would probably have been gagging from the moment the door opened. Even with my mask, my stomach was still doing the twist as I swung my light around to find the source. "Is there a kitchen?" I asked Sybil. "Maybe the previous occupant abandoned 20 pounds of bacon in the fridge."
"No kitchen," my AI replied. "According to the blueprints, it's just this room, the bedroom, and the bathroom."
"Well, it's gotta be coming from somewhere," I said, breathing through my mouth, which actually made it worse since I could taste the stench now instead of just smelling it. "Let's check the bedroom." According to Sybil, the bedroom was to my left, but there were so many boxes in my way that I couldn't even see the door. After much pushing and one really awful encounter with a spiderweb that I don't want to talk about, I eventually spotted my target. A flimsy wooden door with yet another ward etched into its pressboard frame. Unlike the ward on the front door, though, this one was dark. No magic answered me when I poked it, which meant it was either not active, or someone wanted me to think it wasn't active so I'd go through and get fried. Hoping it was the former rather than the latter, I squeezed through the last of the boxes and grabbed the doorknob, which turned easily. But while the door opened, it didn't go more than a foot before hitting something. The obvious guess was more boxes, but this didn't feel like a box. It had too much give, and it made a strange clunk when the door hit it. Curious, I pushed harder, shoving whatever it was back until the crack in the door was wide enough for me to squeeze my head through. And see what was left of the dead body lying face down on the carpet. God damn it, Broker! I yelled into my phone. I was stalking back and forth in the mysteriously wet stairwell, too mad to care that my boots were splashing the unknown liquid up onto my legs. You sold me a coffin!
Calm down, Opal, Broker said,
his drawling voice soothing, like a rancher trying to sweet-talk a sheep off a cliff.
It's not that big a deal.
Not a big deal? There's a dead guy rotting in my unit. Collections is supposed to check for this sort of thing.
They did check, Broker said. It says right here on the unit's record that they tried multiple times to contact the occupant. They even sent someone over to check in person. But he didn't answer.
Of course he didn't answer, I snapped. He's dead. From the smell, I'd say he's been dead the whole 30 days his account's been delinquent. But that's not my problem. My problem is that you sold me a unit full of stuff that I can't sell. The DFC might not have much in the way of laws, but inheritance is still a thing. I bid on that unit because it was small, and I needed the money today. Now I can't touch anything until the city makes 3 good faith attempts to contact dead dude's next of kin, which will take another month at least. Meanwhile, I'm stuck with a unit I can't use, and it's your fault.
No need to get snippy, Broker grumbled. We'll refund your bid, of course. Just give it a week to get through accounting and another 15 business days for processing, and the full amount will be transferred back to your bank account. No problem.
My scowl deepened. How is it that you can take my payment instantly, but when I need it back, it suddenly takes 15 business days?
Hey, I just work here, sweetheart. I don't make the rules. But if you don't want to wait, you can go ahead and take your payment out of what's in the apartment.
I frowned. Is that legal?
It's legal-ish, Broker said slyly. Dead or not, he's still delinquent on his rent. The city has a right to that money, whatever his next of kin says. And since we already recouped it when we sold the unit to you, I don't see why you couldn't take your share of the debt out of his heir's inheritance. We'll just write the whole thing up as a property lien. It's not like anyone's going to challenge it. I mean, the guy's been dead for a month and no one noticed. If he does have an heir, they clearly don't care. The unit will probably be put right back up for sale next month when collections fails to find the next of kin. So think of this as your chance to get the good stuff early. Or wait for the refund. Makes no difference to me.
From the tone of his voice, it clearly made a huge difference to Broker which one I picked. Approving a refund meant formally admitting that someone had messed up. Collection officers were supposed to verify if a unit was still occupied, or had a dead body in it, before putting it up for auction. Obviously, whoever had checked this unit had dropped the ball, which meant Broker had dropped the ball since it was his job as auctioneer to guarantee the units he sold. Sweeping those failures under the rug was undoubtedly why he was so willing to bend the usually intractable cleaning rules into origami for me. A properly ruthless cleaner would have held that over his head. But I had a debt payment due at the end of the week, and I needed my money. If Broker was going to let me pillage the best parts out of this unit without actually cleaning it for resale, the only work cleaners were legally obligated to do after they won a unit, I was happy to oblige. I just hoped there was something in all those boxes that was worth the $300 I'd paid for the privilege of walking in on that horror show. All right, I grumbled. I'll take the unit.
Glad you see it my way, Broker said cheerfully. I'm sending someone over to take care of the body right now. Go ahead and start digging through his stuff. Just do me a favor and don't touch anything that looks personal. You know, just in case they do manage to find someone who cares.
I shrugged. Fine with me. Not like there's a market for family photos.
You're a gem, Opal. See you at the next auction.
I rolled my eyes at the tired old gem compliment and hit the end call button.
So what now?
Sybil asked as I lifted my poncho to slip my phone back into my jeans pocket.
Wait for the disposal team to come for the body?
That could take hours, I said, walking back through the door I'd blown off on my way in. If I had that kind of time to waste, I'd have made Broker give me a legit refund. No. I pulled my gloves back on. We're going to get to work. Technically, AIs don't have actual emotions. But Sybil was a top-of-the-line social companion bot, and she did a good job of sounding legitimately horrified.
You can't start digging through a dead guy's stuff while he's still lying on the floor?
Why not? I asked. It's not as if he's going to complain. And I have a deadline. A hard one. I owed a very nasty individual a lot of money, and he wasn't flexible about payments. If I didn't have the cash by Friday, bad things were going to happen. At least we have a lot to work with, I said, pointing at the wall of boxes. There's so much here, some of it has to be good.
By what logic?
Sybil asked. None, I admitted silently. But my AI already knew she was right, so I didn't bother bumming myself out by admitting the truth aloud. I just grabbed a box off the top of the pile and started ripping it open, peeling off the packing tape with a silent prayer to the living soul of the DFZ that something good was going to come out. Suffice it to say, my prayers were not answered. 2 hours later, 120 disgusting, sweaty, putrid minutes of digging through dusty boxes in a dead man's living room while said corpse was rotting not 10 feet away. I had exactly zero to show for it. The best I could say was that at least it was interesting. Most of the boxes turned out to be full of scholarly books about ancient magical methodologies. Primarily different styles of alchemy, but there were several boxes on ancient Egyptian sorcery, plus a whole stack of books about extinct magical animals. Clearly, whoever our dead man had been, he'd been a fan of historical magic. I could relate. Before my life had gone to hell, I'd gotten my master's degree in magical art history and anthropology, which was a long-winded way of saying I studied old magical stuff left behind by ancient cultures. There was a surprising amount of it. In ancient times, the world had been very magical, even more magical than it was now. Then, for reasons only the Merlins knew, all that power had vanished. For nearly 11 centuries, roughly 1000 to 2035 CE, the world had been completely unmagical, a period we now call the Drought. During that dark time, all of those magical treasures, the enchanted swords and religious relics and other venerated items of power crafted by ancient sorcerers and priests using techniques modern magic still didn't fully understand, lost their power and became merely pretty things. Some were preserved, coveted by various cultures and collectors as sacred objects even if they didn't actually work anymore, but countless more were lost to time. Time and ignorance. We'd never know how many precious treasures had been destroyed by people who couldn't tell the difference between an enchanted hammer of the gods and a hammer you used to build houses. Those objects that did survive regained their power just like everything else when magic had suddenly returned 80 years ago. But so many more were gone forever. Clearly, I wasn't the only one who found that heartbreaking. Our dead guy didn't have any actual relics, much to my dismay. But he had a truly impressive collection of archival photo prints. There were some very detailed pictures of ancient Persian alchemical tools in the boxes that even I hadn't seen before. They were all mass-produced prints, which meant they weren't worth the paper they were printed on. but it was still a lovely collection, and I ended up slipping several photos into my bag for myself. But while I couldn't fault the dead man's taste, books and photos didn't sell. After opening every single one of the 320 boxes crammed into the basement apartment's tiny living room, I estimated the entire collection at around $100, which was 200 short of what I needed just to break even. There was nothing in the bathroom either. So I was forced to move on to the only room I hadn't touched yet. The bedroom. "Excuse me," I said to the dead man as I squeezed inside. "Just here to look around." It was a stupid thing to say and more than a bit macabre. But dead or not, barging into someone's bedroom felt unspeakably rude. Rude and cold. Because after 2 hours of digging through his collection, I felt like I knew the guy. He was a fellow historian, or at least an enthusiastic collector, and that deserved respect. Not, "I'm not going to dig through your drawers looking for hidden lockboxes" levels of respect, but I felt I should acknowledge his presence at least. "What do you think he died of?" I asked Sybil as I started going through the stuff on top of his bureau. "The front door was intact, so I don't think he was killed in a robbery."
"I bet it was something internal," my AI replied, zooming my cameras in on the corpse's face, which was black and sunken with decomposition. "There's no obvious evidence of..."
"Could you not?" I snapped, yanking the cameras back. "This is creepy enough without you going for the close-up."
"I was just answering your question," Sybil said defensively. "As I was trying to say, there's no obvious evidence of violence. No blood splatters or bullet holes or anything like that. Add in the way he collapsed face forward on the ground, and a health crisis seemed most likely. Stroke, heart attack, aneurysm, something like that."
I glanced at the mini-fridge in the corner, which was sitting with its door wide open to reveal the melted, but otherwise completely undecayed, stack of microwave burritos inside. "Going by what he ate, my money's on heart attack." I shook my head. Poor bastard.
"At least this room's not filled with boxes," Sybil said cheerfully. "If I have to look up resale prices for one more stack of dusty old books that don't have proper QR codes, I'm going to log myself out."
I was likewise sick of digging through outdated scholarly paperbacks, but the relative emptiness of this room meant that my chances of earning out on this unit were lower than they'd ever been. Biting my lip, I glanced over my shoulder at the dead guy. It was hard to tell since his clothes were so stained with decomposition, but he didn't look rich. He had none of the flashy jewelry or talismans you normally saw in underworld mages. He wasn't even wearing warded clothes. Other than being dead, the only actual remarkable thing about him was the fact that he had a cybernetic hand. That wasn't unusual in the DFZ. Unlike other countries with their pesky safety regulations, anything you wanted to do to your body was perfectly legal here. Even the really crazy stuff. Implants were cheap, too, since the DFC also didn't require a medical license to install or build cybernetics. Hell, I'd seen homeless guys with camera eyes. But you didn't usually see Augs on mages, since cybernetics interfered with the flow of magic through the body. Given the custom wards on his door and his obsession with ancient magic, I would have thought this guy would rather go handless than give up some of his magic to a machine. But clearly that wasn't the case. Who knew? Maybe he liked having a piece of him that was better than human more than he cared about absolute magical efficiency. Either way, that hand was worth a pretty penny. It didn't look like a high-end model, but you could always sell cybernetics. That said, Broker had only okayed me to loot the unit. He hadn't given me carte blanche to steal from the dead. No one could. Not anymore. Since the return of magic, the world had filled with gods. The first to rise had been Algonquin, Lady of the Great Lakes. The very night magic returned, she'd come out of her lakes in a tidal wave to punish humanity for polluting her waters. The resulting flood had devastated the entire Great Lakes region, but nowhere was hit harder than Detroit. Since it had been one of the greatest polluters, Algonquin's hatred for the Motor City was special, and her wave had wiped it off the map. When she'd finished hammering it into the ground, Algonquin built a new city on Detroit's ruins, the first Detroit Free Zone, and claimed it for herself. The United States of America didn't even fight her over it. They were too busy dealing with the sudden return of mages and dragons and everything else to care about losing a troublesome, bankrupt city. For the next 60 years, Algonquin had ruled the DFZ like an empress, forging it into a magical nexus of unbridled human greed. But the magic wasn't done coming back. The first night had been the most explosive, but the background magic kept creeping up slowly as the decades rolled on. Eventually, the ambient power got so high that it birthed a new god, the spirit of the DFZ itself. The ensuing battle for control of the city had leveled Detroit yet again. In the end, Algonquin got booted back to her lakes, and the new goddess claimed control. That was 20 years ago. The DFZ had rebuilt herself bigger than ever in the years since, and she wasn't alone. The tipping point of rising power that had created her, now known as the Second Crash, brought many other gods as well. Some were old, like Algonquin, and some were new, like the DFZ. But they were all powerful, and an inordinate number of them were gods of death. No one knew how many death gods there were exactly, but their presence meant that doing anything disrespectful to a dead body, especially stealing, was a very bad idea. Death gods weren't forgiving as a rule, and here in the DFZ, the most magical city in the world, they were at their strongest. That cybernetic hand might be worth 1,000 at auction, but the curse I'd get for taking it would cost me a lot more. So I left the hand where it lay and focused on digging through the dead man's underwear drawer, hoping against hope that he'd hidden something of value beneath all his tidy-whities. I'd just moved on to his shirts when I heard someone say my name. I nearly jumped out of my skin. Thankfully, Sybil was on it, swirling my cameras to give me eyes in the back of my head just in time to see a young black man with a rather sketchy-looking tomcat on his shoulder walk through the bedroom door. "Peter," I gasped, clutching my poor chest. "Don't do that to me."
"Sorry, Opal," he said apologetically. "I tried to knock, but the front door was gone."
A smirk spread over his face.
"Not that I should have expected anything less, seeing it was you."
"Hey, I don't always take the door off," I said grumpily, eyeing the folding stretcher he was carrying under his left arm. "But what are you doing here? Broker said he was sending a disposal detail."
"He called in for one," Peter said. "But when I heard that the victim had been dead in his apartment for a month and no one noticed, I volunteered to take care of him."
He reached up to pet his rangy cat.
"He seemed like our kind of fellow."
When he put it that way, it made sense. Peter was a priest for one of those new death gods. Specifically, he'd dedicated himself to the Empty Wind, spirit of the forgotten dead, which definitely included our guy. "Do you need help getting him out?"
"I can manage, thanks," Peter said,
leaning over to let his cat jump down.
"Once we commit the body, he'll get a lot easier to move. The Empty Wind takes care of his own."
From anyone else, that would have been a cryptic thing to say. But Peter made it sound like a blessing. That was how he always talked, though. He came to the cleaner auction sometimes to buy up units he claimed belonged to the forgotten dead. Auctions were always a circus. But even when everyone else was shouting, Peter never raised his voice. He didn't have to. The moment he bid, everyone else shut up. Broker claimed it was all superstition and rallied us to bid higher, but he made his living taking a cut off the top of our auctions. He also didn't understand. I hadn't either before I'd started cleaning. I'd thought the DFZ was just a crazy city with a mind of its own. But get down in the underground where people are really desperate, and you see things. I didn't worship the empty wind like Peter did, but I didn't doubt for a moment that he was real. And spooky as that was, I was happy our dead guy had a god to care about him, since no one else seemed to.
I'll just keep going then, I said, turning back to the drawers. Let me know if you need help.
I will, Peter said. Thank you, Opal.
There was power in those words. Gods had long memories, which meant being nice to priests was always a good idea. I would have helped him anyway, though, because I liked Peter. Priesthood aside, he was a genuinely good guy. Those were a rare commodity anywhere, but they were nigh unheard of in the DFZ. That made me eager to stay in his good graces, even if it meant hauling a dead guy up 2 flights of stairs. Thankfully, it didn't come to that. Peter didn't ask for anything. He just knelt beside the dead man, whispering promises of eternal remembrance in his calm, deep voice, while I dug through the drawers. It was so peaceful, I didn't even flinch when a grave cold wind rose from nowhere, sweeping the heavy, putrid air out of the apartment. I was still appreciating the cool when I heard Peter unfold his stretcher and start loading the body. That broke the spell real quick. Turns out, month-old corpses make horrible noises when you move them. Frantic to distract myself from the nightmare soundtrack going on behind me, I picked up the pace, shoving my hand below the bed, the only place in the apartment I hadn't searched yet. I was groping blindly through the dust bunnies when something sharp stabbed into my finger. Ow!
What?
Peter said, stretcher clattering to the ground. Nothing, nothing, I said, yanking my arm back to cradle my smarting fingers. Just being an idiot. A total idiot. I'd been so eager to take my mind off the goopy biology behind me that I'd broken the number one rule of cleaning. Never put your hand where you can't see it. Luckily, I still had all my fingers, but the first two were burning like they'd been bitten by a wasp rat. If my gloves hadn't been so thick, I would have suspected there was an actual critter under there. But not only was the rubber still whole, my skin looked fine when I yanked my glove off, which meant it wasn't an animal that had bitten me. It was a spell. My face split into an enormous grin. Moving at the speed of greed, I dropped to my stomach and wiggled under the bed, using my headlamps to spot the culprit. A warded box tucked into the gap where the bed's leg met the wall. Not stupid enough to get bitten a second time, I reached into my bag and pulled out my tongs, using the rubber-coated grips to grab the box and ease it out into the light. What came out was a metal container, slightly larger than a shoebox, and absolutely covered in the same bizarre chicken-scratch custom spellwork as the front door. Some of the markings were still glowing from where the spell had zapped me, but unlike the ward on the front door, which could have done who knew what, even I could see this was a security spell. Complicated, powerful, but still just as safe at the end of the day. And if there was anything I'd learned from a year and a half in this business, it was how to crack a safe.
Oh, yeah,
I said as I pulled magic into my hands. Come on, loot box. Since Peter was here, I had to keep my magic toned down, which meant it took me 5 minutes to crush the first lock and a full 10 to crack the next. By the time I reached the final one, Peter had our dead guy wrapped in a dignified sheet on the stretcher. He was clearing a path through the living room to the front door when the warded box in my lap finally clicked open. Completely forgetting my earlier lesson about sticking parts of myself where they shouldn't be, I tore the lid open and shoved my hand inside, grabbing for whatever magical treasure had to be in there. Given this guy's obsession with ancient magic, I was hoping for something really good. A legit alchemical relic, ancient spellwork tablets, old enchanted glass.
What I got was a stack of paper.
What? I cried, turning the box upside down to dump the pile of perfectly normal, not even ancient paper into my lap.
You've got to be kidding me.
They were notes. Notes for what, I couldn't say, since they were written in the same gobbledygook custom spellwork as everything else, but they looked like plans for something complicated. There were tons of size and time calculations written in the margins, along with dollar amounts that made my eyes go wide. I was trying to figure out if they were costs or expected earnings when I found the stack of receipts. I didn't actually recognize what they were at first. I mean, who still used physical receipts? But our dead guy's love of paper must have extended beyond books, because he'd printed and kept hundreds of receipts going back more than a year. Some were for startling amounts, and even more interesting, they were all for magical reagents. In the old days, back when the local ambient power had been too thin to just pull whatever magic you needed out of the air, mages had been forced to use external sources to power their spells, usually the body parts of magical animals. These days, there was so much magic floating around that that sort of thing wasn't necessary, unless you were after a very specific magical flavor or property. But this mage must have been doing something crazy, because he had receipts for stuff I hadn't even heard of. Very expensive stuff. Sybil, I said quietly, fanning the stack of receipts in front of my cameras. What's the total on these?
$283,940.27, my AI replied immediately. It would have been less, but he got rush shipping on a lot of stuff.
That was a number to make my eyes go wide. What was he doing with it all? I whispered. I mean, why pay this much for power when you live in a city that's drowning in free magic?
No clue, Sybil said. But if he'd done it anywhere else, it would have been illegal.
She placed a red arrow on my heads-up display, drawing my attention to a receipt in the middle of the pile.
This one's for a unicorn horn, which only comes off with a unicorn's head. I don't have to tell you how heavily protected unicorns are. They're not even endangered, but humans go crazy any time one gets hurt. If we weren't in the DFZ, just having this paper could get you in trouble.
Maybe that's why he was here, I said thoughtfully. The current DFZ wasn't quite as laissez-faire as it had been under Algonquin's rule. The Spirit of the Lakes had famously cared more for fish than for people, and her lack of laws had shown it. But the modern Detroit Free Zone still lived up to its name. Practically everything short of murder, theft, and slavery was legal here, including, apparently, unicorn poaching. Still. This has to be worth something, I said firmly. You don't spend this much on reagents and not get something good out of the spell.
Well, whatever he was doing, he didn't do it here, Sybil pointed out. There isn't enough room in this apartment for even the starting ritual circle he drew on page one.
That was a good point. You know, I said, looking around the tiny bedroom, which was well-stocked with general supplies like clothes, but curiously light on personal items. I don't think he actually lived here. I think this was a place he ran to in emergencies. You know, like a safe house.
That would explain all of the security, Sybil agreed. And the cruddy location. No one ever seems to hide in nice places.
I nodded, paging through the spell notes again. Even accounting for my terrible skill at reading spell work, they still looked depressingly like a madman's manifesto. Every page was written out to the margins, and there were doodles of weird creatures with chicken heads and snake tails surrounded by arrows and exclamation points. But nutty as the notes looked, they were all I had. There was no way I was hauling 1,000 pounds of books up those slimy, mold-covered stairs for a measly $100. If the spell laid out on these pages wasn't worth money, I'd wasted my entire morning and $300 on this hole. Sybil, Does Heidi Varner still work at the Institute for Magical Arts?
According to her social media, she does,
my AI replied.
Do you want me to send her a message?
No, I said quickly. I hadn't used any of my social media accounts in a year, and I wasn't about to reopen that can of worms for a long shot like this. But where I'd focused primarily on the art and history parts of my magical art history degree, Heidi was a trained thaumaturge with a specialization in ancient alchemy. She also owed me for not telling her boyfriend about the time she got drunk and kissed another guy in college. I'll just pay her a visit, I said. Are her office hours still the same?
Same as when you left, according to IMA's website,
Sybil reported.
But are you sure you want to go? Not that I'd ever read your private mail, but the subject lines of the messages she's sent you over the last year and a half seem pretty angry.
I was sure they did, which was why I'd never looked at them. But desperate times, desperate measures. If there was a chance the spell outlined in these notes was worth anything close to the cost of its reagents, then visiting Heidi was a risk I was willing to take. I was overdue for a change of luck. Maybe our mage had ordered all that stuff but died before he'd gotten the chance to actually cast the spell. For all I knew, there was $283,940.27 worth of reagents just sitting in a warehouse somewhere, waiting for me to come and pick it up.
I guess it could happen, Sybil said when I mentioned this. It's not likely, but...
I know, I said as I tucked the pages into my bag. Just pull the truck around, would you? My AI heaved a long, recorded sigh.
Calling it now.
Thank you, Sybil, I said, walking down the path Peter had cleared through the living room to see if he needed any help getting the dead body up to the street.